start off by showing a few pictures of networks. Get the ball rolling. Here is a picture of a protein interaction network.
Is the network somewhat the same as graph?
Yeah, the network is the same as graph. Pure mathematician. So vertices, proteins, lines between them, edges, are protein interactions deduced probably by yeast 2 hybrid screen in this case. So what can you tell from this picture? It's a pretty picture. What can you tell from it? Nothing, right? It's a big blob on the screen. Here's another example. Also protein interaction network. You know, somebody actually published this as a figure. You're supposed to get something from this. It's not leaping out at me. Here is a metabolic network. So the vertices here are metabolites in the cell. The directed edges linking them together are metabolic reactions, turn one metabolite into another. Again, it's a big blob. This is a portion of the web graph. The nodes are web pages, and the edges are hyperlinks. This is a co-citation network. Nodes are papers, scientific papers, and the edges are common citation of pairs of papers by the same other papers, so some sort of subject matter link. This one is even labeled, but it's still not much use to me. And here's an example of a social network. This is a network of who knows whom or claims to on the online social networking website Friendster. So the nodes are people and the edges between them are this person claims to know this other person. You can't tell anything from looking at these things, right? They're pretty pictures, but they're mostly useless. In the early days of network analysis in the 1930s, you could draw pictures of the networks they had. They had 10 nodes, so they had 20 nodes, and you could sketch it with a pencil on a piece of paper, and you could actually tell useful things by looking at them. Nowadays, this is what you get if you try and do the same thing. There's just too much of it. Mark Vidal calls these things ridiculograms. It's as good a name as any. So a lot of what we do in looking at real-world network data these days is to try and replace what used to be done by eye. You can no longer do serious analysis of networks by eye. So a lot of what we do is trying to find techniques to say what the network looks like when we can't really look at it because it's too complicated. That means, you know, devising network measures like centrality measures that tell you, you know, which are the most important nodes and which are the less important ones, or computer algorithms or statistics of some kind that can give you an idea of what the shape of the network is, even though you can't see that shape. Cool, Wink. So I wanted to talk about a couple of different projects today that are doing that kind of thing. Many of the things that people have done in the past in this line are looking at sort of local measures on networks. They look at things like the degrees of nodes in networks, or the degree distribution, or like this clustering coefficient thing that people look at. You know, if two people are friends of me, what's the probability that they're friends of each other as well? Things like that. The sort of local measures, very useful things. You can gain a lot by looking at that. I want to talk about large-scale structure in the network and ways that we can pick that out. So the first thing I want to talk about is this kind of thing. Many of the networks we look at are divided into groups of some kind, modules or whatever you want to call them. There's some cluster of nodes over here, and they're all connected to each other. And there's some cluster of nodes over here, and all connect to each other. And there's few connections in between the clusters. Okay, so this is not big news. Of course, people have been talking about this kind of thing in networks for decades, but I think there are still some new things to be said about it. So why might one be interested in looking at this sort of structure in networks? Well, first of all, you might be interested just in what the modules are. If you're looking at the World Wide Web, if you've got a cluster of web pages that are all linking to each other, then they might be all pages on related topics, for example. Or if you're looking at a citation network like one that I just showed you, they might be a cluster of papers that were all on a related topic, one sort of little group within the scientific community. In a social network, you might be talking about some community, a little clique of people who all know each other. In a metabolic network, it could be some sort of functional unit, a bunch of metabolites that are all interacting with one another to achieve some mechanical purpose in the cell. So you might just be interested in knowing what these modules were in the first place. That might be a scientifically interesting
Mark,
thing.
Are you looking at something that at modules that are much smaller than the whole network, or like a positive fraction of the number of sites in the network?
Well, either of those is possible. I mean, one of the crucial points that I want to make is that I don't want to say what the size of the modules is. I want to let the network itself fix the size. So it could be either of those things, but both of those possibilities could be real situations. There's another reason why people are interested in these modules, mentioned down here at the bottom, which is that it turns out when you look at these networks, very often the properties of the nodes within different modules are quite different. You can go look at one module and you find, you know, suppose it's a social network, you find that this group of people over here all are very gregarious and they have, you know, 50 or 100 connections within the network. And this group over here only have one or two. That. So you can have different communities that behave very differently.
Mathematicians.
Versus something else. I don't know. So if you were giving some average number, like the average degree of a node in the network, and saying it was 10 or something, you might be missing out on important structure here, not realizing that you have these groups that differ in their properties. Here's just a very simple example of this. This is a network that comes from a paper that Michelle Gervin and I wrote a couple of years ago. This is actually a network of collaborations between scientists, in this case scientists at the Santa Fe Institute, where I used to work. So the vertices are the scientists, and the edges connecting them together are who's written papers with whom. So it's a sort of way of seeing who's been collaborating with whom. And you can see that there are groups in this network, and they're roughly speaking related to different topical areas, RNAs, and physicists here, some ecologists there. And if you look at these groups, you see that they also have different kinds of structure. This one at the top in red, the agent-based models, which is mostly people working in finance, is some kind of distributed thing where there's various different collaborations going on between different pairs of people. This one here in ecology is totally different. It's got this sort of hub and spoke structure. There's this one guy in the middle who's obviously some sort of PI type figure. And then there's, I don't know, his graduate students and postdocs or whoever gathered around him, star-like thing. And if you didn't know about the groups in the network and just started quoting average statistics, like how many collaborators a person has on average, then you might miss out on this interesting qualitative difference in the structure of these groups. Well, this particular example, it's very easy to see. This is one of the ones where you can just look at the network. It's small enough that you can see what's going on, but there are plenty of examples where that's not the case. Here's another network of about the same size, about 100 nodes. And are there groups in this network? You could think maybe there sort of are. It looks like it's a bit denser over here, and maybe you could cut it down the middle into two groups there, but it's definitely not clear. And it's actually no bigger, it's just a lot denser than the previous one. So one basic question you could ask is, can I just find groups in networks? Well, this is something people have been looking at for a long time. There's a large, well-developed literature in computer science. It goes under the name of graph partitioning. What computer scientists tend to look at is the following well-posed problem. If I'm given a graph, I want to break it down into a given number of groups of given sizes such that the number of edges running between the groups, the so-called cut size, is minimized. I want to try rearranging them so that I can make the minimum number of edges run between the groups. So that's a well-posed problem, and that allows you to now say, well, we've shifted the problem to now finding an algorithm that solves that particular problem. And there's a large literature on that, as I say, but the trouble is that it's not really solving the problem that we want to solve. For a start, we don't usually know what the sizes of the groups are in a network. We really want the network to set that. In fact, in many cases, we don't even know how many groups there will be, and there's certainly no requirement that the groups should all be the same size. They might vary in size. So one approach to that is that you could just relax the constraint that the groups are of fixed sizes. This is typically what the computer science people do. So An example of that kind of approach is the so-called ratio cut partitioning approach, which is an approach in which you still have preferred sizes of the groups and you have a penalty for departing from the preferred sizes. But if by doing so you get a better cut, then maybe that wins over the penalty for departing from the preferred sizes. And so that gives you a little bit of wiggle room to try and find the best partition. So those methods also work nicely, but I kind of feel like that's still not really the problem we want to solve. We don't want to say there's a preferred size. We don't want to make any statement about that. We want to let the network decide what's going on here. So in our work, we've taken a different approach, which is instead of fiddling with the constraint, we scrap the constraint altogether and change instead the quantity that you're optimizing. So this leads us to considering this quantity we call modularity. So this is work that I did with Michelle Gerben. We argued that the following. We argued, well, so what the graph partitioning people do is they just minimize the number of edges that run between groups. That seems like a sensible thing to do, but I don't think it's quite the right thing. Our claim is, in fact, that you don't want to just minimize the number of edges between groups. You want to minimize the number of edges compared to the expected number of edges that would run between the same groups. In other words, if I threw down the edges at random, in some sense that I will specify in a moment, then how many edges would run between the groups? And if you think about it, this is probably what people are really thinking about when they think about dividing a network into groups. If you divide something into these modules, and there's a small number of edges running between groups, but it's no smaller than what you would actually expect on the basis of chance, then most people are going to say you haven't found anything. They're going to say, yeah, this is just what I would have expected anyway. There's nothing significant here. What you really mean is that the number of edges between groups is smaller than what you'd expect on the basis of chance. So this leads us to this idea of modularity. We define a different benefit function, Q, which is actually defined in terms of number of edges within groups. It turns out more mathematically convenient to work on with number of edges within groups than between groups, but it makes no difference because the number of edges is fixed. So any edges that are not between groups are definitely within groups. So we're actually going to maximize number of edges within groups minus the expected number of edges within groups. Well, if I want to define this, I need some null model that I'm going to measure things relative to. And there are various different ways you could define this null model. So I'm going to define it by a probability pij that there exists a vertex, an edge between two vertices I and j. If that pij were constant, for example, just equal to some constant value p, then I get the standard Erdős-Mennyi type random graph where edges are just thrown down at random. However, almost all work, including ours, have been done using this modularity measure actually uses a different model, so-called configuration model, which is a model where you get to specify what the degrees of the vertices are. The reason for that is that the degree sequence of the network turns out to be pretty crucial in getting sensible results out of this thing. And if you don't have that right, then it gives mostly garbage. So we actually choose this slightly different choice for the probability of an edge, which is the appropriate one for the configuration model. It's proportional to the product of the degrees ki and kj of the two vertices in question. Other people have taken this idea and then looked at other null models. Certainly, that's something you can do. But the stuff I'm going to be talking about all uses this configuration model. So now we have, again, a nice well-posed problem which turns out to have this neat matrix formulation. I'm going to define a vector.
I have a question. Is ki the actual degree you observe or some theory you have made about the degree?
Oh, no, it's the actual degree observed. Right. Yes. Good question. So it's the degree observed in the real network. So I'm looking at model networks that have the same degree sequence as the real network, but otherwise the edges are randomly placed. Okay, so the way I do this then is I'm going to define a vector which has elements s sub I, one for each vertex, which take values plus and minus 1 if the vertex belongs to group 1 or group 2, and for the moment I'm only going to consider the case of dividing the network into two groups. I will talk about dividing into more groups than that in a moment, but let's just take the very simplest case where I'm dividing into two groups first. So I'm just going to have plus and minus 1s to indicate which group this vertex is in, and then you fiddle around with this for a while and you can convince yourself that this modularity thing has this nice quadratic form. It's got a constant in front which I don't care about. Then this vector S times the matrix B times S again, where B is the adjacency matrix of the graph, that's the matrix with zeros and ones representing the positions of the edges, minus this probability matrix, the probabilities of edges between vertices I and j. We call this modularity matrix. So now we can do something that's very similar.
Sorry, what was A and J?
Oh, sorry, Aij, sorry, I rushed over that. So Aij is the so-called adjacency matrix. It's 1 if there is an edge between I and J, and it's 0 if I don't. So it's, that's where the structure of the network is coming in to this calculation. So I want to maximize this thing, this quality function, by varying S. So the nice thing about this form here is that S contains all the information about how I divide up the network, and no information about the network itself, the network structure itself. All the information about the network structure is in B, and nothing about how the network is divided up. So I've separated the division of the network from the structure of the network. And I want to keep B fixed, that's given to me, and I want to vary S to maximize Q. So we do this, if you're familiar with spectral partitioning, then this calculation will seem familiar. What you do is you express this index vector S as a linear combination of the eigenvectors of a modularity matrix. You fiddle around with that, and you find that the modularity is given as this expansion in the eigenvalues beta sub I of this modularity matrix. So you want to maximize this thing. It turns out, it's actually been proved, Ulrich Brandes and his group proved that this thing, the maximization of this thing here, is an incomplete problem. So it's not going to be easy to do. However, this expression here, which has the eigenvalues in it, well, some of those eigenvalues are big and some of them are small. The ones that are small make small contributions to this, and if we throw away those terms, we still get a pretty good approximation to the modularity. So this expansion here gives us a nice way of making a controlled series of approximations to modularity, where you throw away successive small terms and keep the ones that make the biggest contributions. The most extreme form of such an approximation is to throw away all of them except the largest one, and surprisingly it turns out that even that gives excellent results. You can get very good grasp of what the basic division of the network is just by looking at the leading eigenvector. This is similar to what you do with the feeder vector in spectral partitioning, if you know about that. Yes.
So the concept of incompleteness, in the incompleteness group, so presumably the problem which that refers to, they did this online, it would not be a very good result, is that true? The partition of the sort of real world graphs?
Well, yeah, so so if you are looking at sort of a complete ensemble of random graphs, for example, then many of them wouldn't have any division that had high modularity. And so you could look at the leading eigenvector, but it would be essentially meaningless because there isn't a good division of them. There's kind of no point in doing this if there isn't a good division of the network to be found in the first place. I guess the claim is that if there is a clear division of the network, then making a fairly crude approximation to this modularity is the point. If there's no clear division, then it won't find it, but then you probably won't actually find it.
Well, is it proven to be NP-complete even to approximate? Maybe just NP-complete to do exactly.
Oh, absolutely. No, only NP-complete to do approximate. I'm about to tell you about a polynomial time algorithm to do it approximately.
Yeah.
So obviously it's not. Of course, there are approximation algorithms to do it, but yeah.
So are you claiming that when the leading eigenvalue is a good approximate, and there is a division, and is this supposed to be an equivalent?
Let me think about that.
Equivalent?
So large values, so this thing here ranges between 0 and 1, and I think large values indicate that there is a good division, because what it says is that there is some division such that the number of edges between groups is much smaller than you would expect on the basis of chance. And we're defining that to be what we mean by a good division. And if there is, see, all of these coefficients here are non-negative. So if there is a large eigenvalue of this thing here, then this thing here will be large, and then there will be a good division in this hypothetical, this sense that we've hypothesized, that we define that to be our good division. So in that sense, I guess, if there is a large beta sub I, then there should be a good division, in the sense that we define that to be what we mean by a good division. So if you only keep the leading eigenvalue here, then it turns out the algorithm is very simple. Maximizing this is just done by the following very simple algorithm. You take the leading eigenvector, U1 here, And you divide up the vertices into two groups according to the signs of the elements of that vector. If the corresponding element is positive, you put it in one group, and if it's negative, you put it in another group, and that maximizes your group. Maybe there's some other division that's also competitive. Right, so I think what this tells you is that if you have two large eigenvalues, the largest one will give you a good division, but the second largest one would probably also give you a good division. It's telling you that there's more than one possible division of this network, and they're both reasonably good. But they're both good in the sense that the number of edges running between the two groups will be significantly smaller than you expect in the basis of chance. So yes, you could have more than one competing one. That doesn't mean that the first one's bad, but it could mean that there's another one. Okay, so this turns out to work well, at least in cases where the network actually does have a division that's worth finding. Here, I'll give a couple of examples, just sort of fun examples from things that I've worked on. This is a network that I worked on with a marine biologist called David Lousseau, who's at Dalhousie in Nova Scotia. So he works on dolphins. And this is a friendship network of dolphins. David spent about 7 years bobbing around on boats in Doubtful Sound, New Zealand, watching dolphins. This is one of the dolphin groups that he watched. There are 62 dolphins in this group, and after you watch them for a few years, you get to know them pretty well. And dolphins apparently are very sociable creatures, and they have certain actions that they do that sort of indicate, they do repeatedly, that indicate that these dolphins like each other. So he was able to sort of ascertain who's friend with who in this dolphin community. And constructed several different networks like this. I chose this like example because it's interesting. Something interesting happened. While he was watching this particular group of dolphins, one of them, that one there, the yellow triangle, disappeared for about 2 years. It turns out that it wasn't dead, just gone off somewhere. And when it did, this whole group split into two, the green ones and the red ones. Apparently, this dolphin in the middle here was just sort of the glue holding it all together. And when that one went away, it split into two parts. So it's an interesting question. Could you sort of predict how it was going to split by looking at the structure of the network? And the answer is you can do it reasonably well. If you take this network and feed it through the spectral method that I just described, it says you should divide the network down that dotted line there. It's approximately what happened in real life. There are a few dolphins here that got put on the wrong side of the line. But basically, it's found that yes, there's a dense group over here and this dense group over here, and it divides fairly cleanly.
Mark, you've got an unweighted graph there. If he had taken into account how strong the friendships were, I mean, you could run a weighted graph through,
absolutely,
through
yeah,
your algorithm, and then it might have predicted even better.
That's
certainly
possible.
Well anyway.
That's certainly possible. There's a very straightforward generalization that has the weighted graphs. You just do the obvious thing. You put the weights and the adjacency matrix in it, follow the calculation through. Yes?
The top two green nodes on the left-hand side, if you move them over to the right, your dotted line would only cut three lines instead of five.
Absolutely.
That points to, if you play a little bit with the target function, probably those two guys would move over.
Right.
Especially if you just count
well,
the number
or
of...
Or it might be weighted.
Line.
Well, so
it might not be weighted, but you wouldn't even have to weight it. I mean, that's the difference between the two places probably just comes from the substance.
So make three comments. One is, remember that you're not just trying to minimize the cut size.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to minimize cut size relative to what you expect on the basis of chance. So it's not guaranteed that that will give you a better value of the modularity. However, it's possible. So that is something that we do, in fact. So this is just a raw division using the spectral method. But another thing we've done is take the raw division using the spectral method and then optimize it using some greedy optimization, starting from what the spectral method gives you. It gives you a nice image of the big picture, and then you can refine it slightly as you go along. And I had a third point, but I forgot my words.
Was this based on the approximation, just using the principle?
Yeah. Oh, that was my third point. Thank Thank you very much. The other point is that, of course, we've made an approximation in order to do this maximization, and so it's possible that this thing just gets slightly the wrong answer because you've made one. Thank you.
Now, can you predict something about which ones are the crucial dolphins, which if they go off for a little while?
Hmm. Okay, well, I mean, you could do the, I'd have to think about that one. That's a good question. That's a nice question. Could you predict the keystone ones? Yes.
So you know that the underlying data probably are not terribly exact here.
Right.
Subject the case in all the other examples. So if I mess around with some of the links, so how sensitive is this to
that's an excellent point. That's something that we're looking at, but I don't have any very good results to report on that yet. So this is a general excellent question about almost all network analysis problems, that if there's errors in my data, if there is missing or some present that shouldn't be there, how much is it going to change my answer? How fragile is the conclusion? I don't know the answer. There was no role in this calculation of the yellow triangle. That was just part of the story. The yellow triangle is the guy who disappeared.
What is the difference between the cuts and the different colors?
So the dotted line is what the algorithm found, and the colors are what happened in real life when the thing split into two different groups.
What if you remove the triangle? What would your algorithm then?
I tried that and it makes no difference. It puts the gun in the same place. Okay, and here's one other example before I talk about a couple other things. This is another sort of fun example. This is a network that I got from Wallace Krebs. It's a network of books. There are books about US politics. All of them written about the time of the last US presidential election. And they're conveniently colored blue on the left there, red on the right. So for example, you have The Faith of George W. Bush and The Lies of George W. Bush. And what are the edges? The edges are frequent co-purchasing on Amazon.com. If you go on Amazon, they have this thing which says, people that bought this book also bought this other book. You've seen that thing? Yeah? So that's what that is. Well, this just went on Amazon, he looked up all of these books, and he put in all of these edges here. And what you see is lots of edges between the blue books and lots of edges between the red books and very few edges going across. Not a big surprise, maybe, but it indicates that this network should have the sort of community structure that I'm talking about. And it turns out that it does. You can take this network and feed it into the spectral algorithm I just told you about, and it divides it nicely into a blue group and a red group. But you can do more than that. What I've done here is I've actually colored them according to the magnitude of the corresponding element of the leading eigenvector. If you think about it, if you have an element that's very close to zero, then you could have perturbed your network just a little bit, and it might have changed the sign of that element, and therefore flipped it from being a positive one to a negative one, and it would move into the other group. So the ones with elements that are very close to zero are only sort of weakly in the group they're in. Whereas if your element is very far away from zero, then you're going to need a big perturbation to move it into the other group. So you can think of the magnitudes of the elements as saying how firmly you're in one group or the other. So you can not only divide it into two groups in this case, but you can also say which are the most left-wing books and which are the most right-wing books. If you're interested in politics, you might like to know that the most left-wing book in this case is the book Bushwhacked by Molly Ivins, which is not a big surprise, maybe, if you know that book. The most right-wing book is very interesting, actually. It's the book A National Party No More by Zell Miller, who, as you may know, is a former ostensibly Democratic senator from the great state of Georgia. Okay, so going back to the math here, let me mention a couple of properties of this modularity matrix that I talked about. The vector all ones, 1, 1, 1, 1, is always an eigenvector of this matrix, and it has eigenvalue 0. In this, it's rather similar to the graph Laplacian, if you're familiar with that. However, unlike the graph Laplacian, this matrix can have both positive and negative eigenvalues. this is useful because it means that so long as there is any positive eigenvalue to this matrix, you will get a non-trivial division of the network, because the eigenvector has to be orthogonal to 1, 1, 1, which means it must have some positive values and some negative values. So you'll get a division into two parts. So it's not like conventional graph partitioning, where you're just minimizing the cut size. If you just minimize the cut size with the sizes of the groups allowed to be anything, then your optimum is to stick all of the vertices in one group together, because that gives you a cut size of zero, and no vertices in the other group. So you that if you just relax your condition on the sizes of the groups in conventional graph partitioning, you always get a trivial answer, which is you just put all the vertices in one group together. You don't get that in this case. You'll get a non-trivial answer, provided there is any positive eigenvalue of this matrix. However, interestingly, it turns out that sometimes there is no positive eigenvalue. There's only zero and negative eigenvalues, in which case the algorithm is telling you that there is no good division of this network. It's telling you that the best division, the most positive eigenvalue, is the zero one, which corresponds to the vector 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, which is put all the vertices in one group and none of them in the other. In other words, it's saying don't divide the network. So this is really interesting. It says that this method is capable not only of dividing the network, but it's also capable of telling you when you shouldn't divide the network. It's capable of saying, no, I refuse to divide this network because there just isn't any good way of dividing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This method that you're describing is linear. Does it make any difference if the connections are non-linear?
In what sense?
No. The cutting positions might be changed.
No. In what connection? In what sense do you mean non-linear connection?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I suppose you could mean that the benefit function was non-linear in the cut size or something like that. Absolutely. So in what I'm doing here, I'm specifying the benefit function. Mm. If one changed the benefit function, then absolutely it would make a difference to the results. I feel that there is some justification, sort of on first principles, for the particular benefit function that I've chosen here. But I certainly accept that there could be other benefit functions than my given results. Absolutely.
I'm not seeing the difference between positive and negative.
Sorry?
If I have an eigenvector corresponding to a negative eigenvalue.
Oh, actually, well, that's a very good question. Can I get back to that in just a moment? I will treat that in just a moment. So this gives you, this here gives you a nice thing. It becomes important when you want to discuss division into more than two groups. So there's various ways of dividing into more than two groups, but the one that's typically used in spectral partitioning, the one that we use as well, is just repeated division into two. In other words, you divide it into two, and then you divide the parts into two, and you keep going, and the question is, when do you stop? The answer is, you stop precisely when there are no positive eigenvalues of your modularity matrix. That's the point at which the method tells you there's no more gain in modularity to be had by further subdividing this network. So if your goal is to optimize the modularity, you should stop at this point. So you end up with a very nice, simple algorithm which says, find the leading eigenvector, split, find it again, split, and keep on doing that until the leading eigenvector does not correspond to a positive eigenvalue, but corresponds to a zero one, and at that point you just stop, and then you're done. Yes?
Yeah, Mark, how do you know that dividing in two is better than dividing in three, for example?
You don't, absolutely. It's certainly possible that the best division into three parts is not necessarily achieved by the best division into two parts and then dividing one of the other two parts. In fact, I can give you explicit examples where that is not the case. So I know absolutely that this will fail in some cases. However, that's hardly surprising. It's a polynomial time algorithm addressing an NP-complete problem. So I know already that it must fail in some cases. Certainly there are other ways you could do it, but if they're polynomial time, they will also fail in some cases. There was actually a question over here.
Yeah, so when you say divide those parts, you mean just take the subgraph of the one side, effectively, and do the algorithm to that?
Yeah. Well, I'm swimming a little bit under the carpet here. You can't quite do that. You actually have to take account of the fact that it's still connected to the rest of the graph in order to calculate the modularity matrix twice. And I written down the details here, but I'd be happy to explain that later. Yeah.
Well, have you tried, like, in spectrographic literature, a lot of them do k-means in the, so you take like a few eigenvectors and you do k-means in that space. Have you tried?
Yeah. So indeed. So we've also tried things like that, and that does work quite well, but it's less computationally efficient than doing this. It might give slightly better quality answers. The basic result is that if the divisions of the network are very clear, which they are in some cases, then you get pretty much the same answers whatever way you do it.
Because you say, oh, well, if you don't want to divide into just two, you might want to divide into three.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So the answer is yes, we have tried things. and they work quite well. They work reasonably well. It's not the main approach.
So when you say things are not like they should be by chance, normally what I would want to look at is not just do they deviate from the expectation, but do they deviate more than expected. So do you have something like a chi-squared test, whether you think it's sort of...
So you can do things like that. So we have done things where you can calculate, not actually a chi-squared test, but we just calculate the standard deviation of the modularity within the appropriate null model, and then calculate the p-value for the modularity observed relative to the null model. So you can say, how likely is it that I got a modularity value this big purely by chance? So you can certainly do things like that. I actually think that you can do that, but I think that a more useful approach is, somebody else asked a question earlier about the robustness of the thing. A more useful approach is actually to ask what happens when you randomize the network slightly. How much of a difference does that make? Because really what you want to ask is not just how big the value of your modularity is, since that's not a very useful number. What you really want to ask is how much would you have to change the network in order that you would lose that modularity advantage and just get something similar to what you'd see around the world. So the approach we're taking at the moment is more a robustness to changes in the data. We end up with a rather nice algorithm, which is just repeatedly subdivide this thing until there are no positive eigenvalues, and then stop. I want to talk about one other thing before I finish. So let me just quickly mention, since somebody asked about it, you could also look at the negative eigenvalues. Those tell you about minimization of modularity. In other words, you're looking for structures like this, where the number of edges between groups is maximized, not minimized. In other words, they're bipartite or approximately bipartite structures. That can tell you interesting things for some networks as well. Here's just one quick example of this. This is a network of word adjacencies. In this case, they're English words taken from the text of the novel David Copperfield by Charles Dickens, which I chose just because it's one of my favorites and it's available free online. And they're adjectives and nouns. In English, adjectives usually come before nouns. So if you put an edge between any two words that occur next to each other in the text, most of the edges are going to fall between an adjective and a noun. Sometimes they'll fall between a noun and a noun, and sometimes between an adjective and an adjective, but not so. So this network, we would expect to be approximately bipartite, kind of like the thing I just showed. But you would be hard-pressed to tell that by looking at this. This is just a conventional spring embedder picture of a network, and it's pretty hard to tell that there's interesting structure there. However, if you do that division according to the most negative eigenvalue of the modularity matrix, it divides it up into this group and this group, and you can see it's put most of the green ones, the adjectives, in one group, and most of the red ones, the nouns, in the other. So it's discovered that this network has most of its edges running between the two groups and very few edges within the groups. So that's difficult to tell by looking at the regular visualization, but once you look at this eigenvector, you can see the interesting. Okay, so I just have a few minutes left. I wanted to talk about one other recent project that we've been working on that's trying to take this kind of idea a little bit further. This is stuff that I worked on with Elizabeth Light. And the kind of structures I've been talking about are of a very specific kind. There are groups of vertices, and there's lots of connections within this group and lots of connections within that group. That's not the only way you could define a group of vertices. There are actually many other ways you could define a group of vertices. Maybe this group here is defined by the fact that its vertices have a bunch of connections to people over here, and a few to people down here, and not very many people down here, and a few in its own group as well. You know, there could be any pattern of connections you like defining the members of this group. It doesn't have to be I'm connected to other members of my own group. You can have much more general things than that. So what Elizabeth and I were looking at is ways of detecting this far more general kind of classification of vertices into groups in networks. So this turns out that there's a nice way of doing this using a very standard piece of machinery from statistics literature. What we do is we propose a model for that kind of structure in a network, a probabilistic model, a mixture model, technically, and then we fit that model to the observed data, the network, using a maximum likelihood scheme. So in other words, we vary the parameters of the model to maximize the likelihood that the network we saw was generated by the model. So the model is like a sort of random graph model. It has a bunch of probabilistic parameters in it. The definition is that you have one probability pi sub r, which is the probability of belonging to group R. And then these are the crucial parameters. Theta ri is the probability that a vertex which is in group R links to vertex R. So these things here really define the structure of the groups. That's the pattern of probabilities of linkage that a guy has if they belong to a particular group R. And there's a different set of these probabilities for each of the groups. I won't go into the details here, but it turns out that there's a nice way of fitting this model to the data. You can calculate a likelihood function for the data given the model, or a log likelihood function like this one down here. But unfortunately, it involves the group memberships G sub I. G sub I is the group that vertex I belongs to. And those are things that we don't know. However, we can estimate them from the data, that is, the network, if we know the model parameters, which we don't, but let's forget about that. We can say what is the probability Q sub IR that vertex I belongs to group R, and you sort of fiddle around with it a bit, and get an expression for that in terms of the model parameters pi and theta, and A sub IJ, which is again the adjacency matrix of the network. Yeah?
Sorry, but we had a whole bunch of parameters here, way too many.
I have a lot of parameters. I have an extensive number of parameters.
One for each group and each vertex.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. So we can talk about that more, but yeah, so this is quite a common approach in these kinds of models. This is a very standard way. So given these parameters and the adjacency matrix, so this is your input data, of which there are n squared elements, of course, you can get out these probabilities of belonging to each of the groups, but it involves the parameters of the model, which we don't know. However, it turns out that by some more juggling, well, by maximizing this likelihood function, you can get estimates of what those parameters are. Here they are, pi and theta, in terms of which groups each vertex belongs to. So now you have two sets of simultaneous equations. You have model parameters expressed in terms of group membership and group membership in terms of model parameters. And you want to solve those two things simultaneously. And the simplest way of doing that is just by numerical iteration. You get a value, you plug it in, you go around, you get a better value, you keep on doing that until it converges. That can be proved to converge to a maximum of the expected log likelihood, so it's going the right way. In other words, when you iterate, it's giving you things that are better estimates, not worse estimates.
When you go to maximum.
Sorry?
When you go to maximum?
To a local maximum, absolutely, yes. And this has a number of advantages. So this is a standard approach. It's called an expectation maximization algorithm. It's very simple. You know, I've skipped over the derivation here, and it's a little bit involved. But the bottom line is three equations. You just iterate them. You know, to program it, you have to do some setting up of variables and stuff like that. But the real guts of the thing is like 5 lines of computer code. As a result, it's also very fast. You can do it on big networks and get answers out quickly. And it has this nice feature that it simultaneously tells you these Q parameters, which are which vertex belongs to which group, and also these theta parameters, which are sort of the definitions of the group. It says that this group is defined as being the people that mostly connect over here and have a few connections over here and a few connections within the group, or something like that. Whatever is the best definition of groups for this particular network, that's what it goes for, right? You don't tell it what the definition of the groups is going to be, it just finds one that allows it to describe in a simple fashion the network that was observed.
Yes, but the EM algorithm is typically widely known to be the one of the faults is that it's very slow. So, so
Well, not. Maybe that's only by comparison with some of the other algorithms that we use for doing graph partitioning type problems.
The reason is that the EM algorithm, typically what happens in large parameter ones is the likelihood becomes very flat. And so it seems that it has converged, but it really has not. So it goes on and on forever. So.
Well, so it, I mean, it may well be that it is slow by comparison with other ways of maximizing the likelihood. I'm only really saying that it's fast by comparison with other ways we have of finding groups in networks. So I'd be quite happy to learn that there were faster ways of doing this than this, but this one we've actually had a lot of success with. Compared to the other things we've been doing, it gets answers pretty quickly.
But it quickly means?
Meaning in seconds. Not
well, how many
whereas
how many iterations, 100, 1,000, how big is the network?
Well, so it depends on the size of the network. We've been looking at networks that have thousands of vertices, and you typically need tens of thousands of iterations or hundreds of thousands. But with a modern computer, that's, you know, nothing.
So your network is 1,000, like 1,000?
Well, it's thousands of vertices,
so
yeah. Those are typical examples. So
but you had roughly n squared.
No, you had n, roughly n primes. Well, number of groups times number of vertices. Some number times n. So just before I finish, let me give you a few examples of applications to this. Of this
Mark,
algorithm.
Can I just ask you one thing? You said that it tells you what the groups
right.
should be. You don't specify how many groups there should be?
No, you do actually.
Yeah, because otherwise it would just
so
it could just go down to single
talking about,
points.
You don't. It finds its own number of groups. In this particular case,
you would have
to specify number groups.
Okay,
there are ways of doing that, you know, maximizing marginal likelihood, Bayesian inference.
Okay. Because you would have to tell something. Otherwise, if you don't tell what the groups are or how many,
so there are other ways of doing that. So mostly based on marginal likelihood or based on pullback Likelihood distance, but they're separate from the algorithm itself. You have to choose that independently and then feed it into the algorithm.
Okay.
So here I'm sort of saying I've specified that this one's going to have two groups.
Okay.
This is a nice example. It's actually a famous network from the social science literature, a very small network. It's a network of the members of a club, a karate club at a US university. It's famous because, so it's something that was an anthropologist studied these guys in the 70s for about 2 years as part of his PhD thesis, a guy called Wayne Zachary. And this network was famous because while he was watching this particular club, it split into two parts as a result of a dispute over whether to raise the fees. And he noticed, you know, who went off in the two different groups after it split. And the claim is that you can see how it was going to split by looking at the structure of the friendships between the individuals before the split happened. So this is psychohistory, if you're an Asimov fan. This is predicting the social future of this group by looking at social interactions. And it turns out that it works quite well. So here we fed it into this EM algorithm. And it says, indeed, that you should split it into two groups as denoted by the colors here. And they correspond exactly to the groups observed in the real world, which are denoted by the two green shapes there. It also does some other things. For example, along the boundary here, you can see some kind of grayish nodes. Those are ones which were mostly put in this left-hand group, but have some probability to be in the right-hand group. One of the nice things about this method is it gives you not just I'm in this group or I'm in this group, it gives you the probability to be in one group or another. So it gives you some sort of fuzziness there, and you can see that those guys along the boundary were a bit conflicted about whether they should be in the left-hand group or the right-hand group.
What would your modularity have given here?
That also picks out the right groups in this case. So both of those methods do a good thing. So this is something which could have been tackled using modularity. So is this. This is, again, that network of nouns and adjectives. And it's, again, picked out from the adjectives just as the modularity thing did. But the crucial point is that with the modularity, I had to decide whether I was going to maximize it or minimize it in order to get the appropriate result. Here, I just used the exact same program, unmodified, didn't change anything, fed the network into it, and it sees that the best definition of groups in this network is one where the edges run between groups, not within groups. That's the nice thing, is that it's picking out what the definition of the group should be, as well as who should go in which group. You don't have to tell it that I'm looking for this kind of structure or that kind of structure. So it can look, find much more general things. I'll skip that one because I'm running out of time. Let me give you two quick other examples. This is a network that is constructed on the computer that this way there's not very many edges running. This way there's lots of edges running. So it's kind of like a mixture of the different kinds of networks I showed before. The positive modularity edges within groups one and the negative modularity edges between groups one. If you used your modularity method on this, it would find a split this way or this way, depending on whether you maximized or minimized, but it wouldn't find all four groups. This method has no problem finding this funny mixed structure. It just determines that that's the appropriate structure for this network and finds the four groups. So the dotted lines are the actual groups and the colors are what the algorithm found. And again, it's done a pretty good job of finding what was there. One more example. This is a completely different kind of network that's not any of the kinds that I talked about before. This is one where I put edges randomly between vertices, except for these eight, what I call keystone vertices in the middle. Each of these four groups is connected to two of these keystone vertices. Every member has connection to two of the keystone vertices. Other than that, all of the edges, which is the vast majority of edges, are just totally random. So there's a little signal of group membership here, which is that each vertex is connected to some leader figure. But other than that, all of its connections are completely random. If you take that network and feed it through your conventional community detection method, it comes up with random garbage. If you feed it into this EM algorithm, again, it's spotted what the correct definition is. It's spotted that it's really only supposed to be looking at these two edges, and it can just ignore all of the other edges and divide it neatly into its four groups. It even worked out that the eight keystone vertices in the middle are different. It gave each one of those about 25% chance of going to each of the four groups. It didn't assign them to any groups. It spotted that that's not the right thing to do. So again, the method doesn't have to be told what sort of structure it's to look for. It just sort of rummages around until it finds something that describes.
But you did have to say there were four groups.
That's true. I did. Absolutely correct. I did have time. Okay, so I'm out of time. I'd better stop talking now, but thank you for your attention. Here's a few references in case you want to look any of this stuff up, and all of these papers appear on my website there. Thanks very much.